Accession number 8235, roll number 2.
Brigadier Scott, reel 2.
Our forces consists of 4 brigades with 4 regiments of Royal Artillery, 1 medium and 3 field, 25 pounders, and 50 I tanks, Matildas. These were heavily armoured tanks, as opposed to the Italians, who had pretty light tanks compared to us. Now the thing about the I tanks was, that time, as far as I remember, they didn't have enough tank transporters to bring them forward. So most of the I tanks had to do the whole journey, or most of the journey, on their own tracks. The result was that by the end of the battle, a number of I tanks, despite the magnificent work done by their maintenance crews, were out of action owing to their track failures. I should like to mention here that the idea was that while the 4th Indian Division attacked these Italian strongholds, the 7th Armoured Division held the cordon. Now, the 7th Armoured Division, all the early days of the war, had put constant pressure on the Italians by their, as I said before, aggressive reconnaissance. And I think one of the reasons why the Italians were surprised, which they were completely, was that they thought the noises they heard were the usual reconnaissance carried out with 7th Armoured Division. Also, another factor was that the Italians didn't seem to go in for patrolling at all. This was also noticeable in the Eritrean campaign. Having got behind the position at Nabaiwa, on the 9th of December, Lemper Brigade was in the position to attack, which they did at dawn, supported by the I tanks and a preliminary heavy bombardment by the artillery. Meanwhile, while the attack was going on, 5th Brigade slipped past 11th Brigade and attacked the Tamars, Tamar East and Tamar West. And by the end of the day, that by nightfall, Nabaiwa and the Tamars were in our hands, and there was just mopping up to do. On the 10th and 11th of December, the 16th British Brigade and 11th Brigade then moved past and took Benghazi. Meanwhile, the 7th Armoured Division had gone on in their usual aggressive style right onto Safafi and cut the main road. This, I should like to point out at this stage the value of communications and the breakdown which occasionally took place, because during the night of the 10th and 11th of December, 16th British Brigade was completely out of touch with their armour and their artillery. As divisional liaison officer, I was sent out to try and find out where they were. I may say it was quite a hopeless task in the dark and in the confusion. I never found them. But that was an example of a breakdown in communication, very important. They did, actually, before dawn, contact the 16th Brigade. By this time, of course, we had thousands and thousands of prisoners of war. And the task of looking after prisoners of war and sending them back, it was quite a big one. I myself had an Italian officer's prisoner of war in my truck. Of all things, he was a Serbian. He spoke a little Italian, not very much, and he spoke a little bit of French. I don't know what he was doing in the Italian army. He was with me for about a couple of days, and he's a very nice chap. Now, Max Seton and I, that evening, started to interrogate some of the officers. As we were walking down the line of officers, Max stopped in front of one of the officers and said, "What the hell are you doing here, Anthony?" Anthony said to Max, "Oh, what are you doing, Max?" It so happened that Max and this chap, Anthony, were at Clifton together. So that evening, this Italian officer and Max and I sat down together with a bottle of whiskey, our bully beef and biscuits, and had a little party. As can be imagined, the effects on the division as a whole was tremendous. It was our first battle. It had gone like clockwork. And the great thing was, it showed that training was on the correct lines and we had very few casualties. This is very important for a first battle, I think. It also showed that the constant training we'd done by night, especially in the movement of vehicles, had paid off. And once more, it showed that General Wavell's plan of complete surprise had come off. As Andy Anderson of the Camerons, the CEO of the Camerons, said, if you had been at the Staff College and that had been your plan, you'd have failed.
You mentioned early on in your description of this battle that security was very strict indeed. Was that because there was a real risk of espionage?
No, I don't think the risk of espionage. The risk was that we were constantly sending people back to Alexandria and even to Cairo, either for replenishing our stores or what have you. And that was the risk. There's no really risk of espionage.
Now, you also said that you were in Wavell's headquarters, you were in divisional headquarters as a liaison officer. What were your duties as a liaison officer?
My duties at that time were pretty, fairly static, really. I had to know the detailed formation of all the brigades and the ancillary services, and of course the gunners and tanks, and I had to know the commanders, get to know the commanders. In the same way, really, as later on, that Monty made use of his liaison officers. While I was doing a liaison course in Cairo, or outside Cairo, General Wavell came down himself, I remember very well, and gave us a talk on the importance of liaison officers. My divisional commander at the time, of course, was General Beresford Pierce, who was a gunner.
What was he like to work for?
Oh, he's very, very, very easy to work for, and absolutely first-class commander. The 4th Indian Division is very lucky in having a succession of absolutely first-class divisional commanders.
How was the plan actually formulated? Were you on the divisional staff when the plan was actually being drawn up?
No, I wasn't on the divisional staff when the plan was being drawn up, which is, in fact, it came as a bit of a surprise to me.
Did you have an opportunity to look at the Italian positions when you were in the battle or after the battle?
Yes, I had a look at the position in the Biwa, and also over to Mars, very briefly after the battle. It was quite obvious they'd been completely taken by surprise, because there was even the food uneaten, which has been very early dawn, and that sort of thing. You could see they were absolutely, and of course there was chaos inside the camps, as far as ammunition lying around and transport, all the rest of it.
What sort of actual defences did these positions have?
Positions had they're very well wired, but for some reason, on the east side of each position, there was a gap, which really it proved fatal. Because that's where we came in. We breached the gap. There were two or three belts, as far as I remember, of wire, and there were deep anti-tank ditches also between the wires. Otherwise, there were trenches inside the strong points.
Were there any pillboxes or any concrete blockhouses?
There were no concrete blockhouses, far as I know, I remember, or anything like that.
Were the trenches well dug and well positioned?
Yes, the trenches were well dug and well positioned.
You mentioned the I-tanks suffering losses due to their tracks wearing out and so on. Did any of them actually get knocked out by the enemy?
I don't think one tank got knocked out, as far as I know.
What sort of assault tactics did the infantry use when they were making the attack?
Well, to start off, we had a heavy bombardment by the artillery, and it must be again emphasized that the enemy was really taken by surprise. They had with their pants down, almost literally speaking. Then the tanks went in, followed up by the infantry. That was the order of the attack.
So the infantry presumably had practiced this sort of combined assault.
Yes, the infantry practiced this.
Now, you said that one of the reasons why the Italians were caught napping was that they didn't seem to patrol at all.
Yes, that's right.
Have you no idea why they didn't?
No idea at all.
And you also mentioned moving up at night, large formations of vehicles. What were the basic principles for safe and effective movement at night without getting lost or dispersed?
Here again, you followed right on the principle of the Navy. You followed the chap in front. But this was only done by constant practice. That was really the answer to it. Because you had no lights, and of course you had the odd accident, one going, vehicle going to another, and a vehicle getting stuck in the sand. But it was constant practice. We were always practicing night movement.
As far as the prisoners of war are concerned, you mentioned you had a Serbian who was a very nice character. Did you discuss the battle with him when he was with you?
Well, yes, we did. But owing to the language problem, it was a bit not very clear. But he said they were rather complacent. They thought they were quite happy where they were. And they were completely taken by surprise.
And you also mentioned going down the line of officers and speaking to them. Did you get anything useful out of them, any useful information?
No, not much. Very little.
What was their demeanour and attitude when they were lined up?
I had the impression that they really, not all, but quite a lot of them, they hadn't got their heart in the war at all. Including this officer I had with me. One had the impression they were rather forced into it.
Did they say anything specific about not wishing to be involved in?
No, I don't think they said that. But by the general, they seemed to be quite happy to be taken prisoner, most of them.
Had they suffered heavy casualties during the fighting?
Yes, they had. Far more than we had. I wouldn't know what the actual casualty list was. It was as far heavier than ours.
Now, this officer called Anthony, could you tell me a bit more about him, about how he'd come to be in the Italian army? No,
I'm afraid I don't remember at this stage any more about him than that rather brief encounter we had. And he was a very pleasant chap and spoke quite good English.
What happened after Sidi Barrani?
We were about to reform and preparatory to advancing. When I remember very clearly, I think it was on the night of the 11th or 12th of December, being told that the division was going to be about turn and go back, to everybody's utter astonishment. I heard this about 4 o'clock in the morning at divisional headquarters. And the first brigade to move back was the 11th Brigade, which had just taken part in the Sidi Barrani attack. And no sooner they were gathering themselves to go forward again and reorganize when they were suddenly told, back to Cairo as fast as you can.
And from there presumably went on down to the Sudan.
And from there the whole division moved down to Sudan.
I'd like to ask you about the battalion. Presumably you rejoined the battalion around that time.
No. What happened was that I personally was sent off straight away before the division even got time to move to GHQ to help in the movement of the division to Eritrea.
What sort of help did you do?
Well, my office consisted of a sergeant. He was a South African who was on the South African Railways in quite a high-up position, movement of rail, and one clerk. And we worked very closely with GHQ Q movements. At that time, when the division moved down to Cairo, they didn't know where they were going to after that. And I remember the division being at Amaria, and I went up one morning with a whole lot of maps and handed them over to our G1, Colonel Rees, who later commanded the 19th Brigade in Burma. And there he was having his usual cup of tea. He always had drank tea by a cupful. And he was astonished when I put the maps in front of him and said, "This is where we're going."
So you were working out the train schedules, were you, for movement?
Yes. Train and road. Because the Div headquarters went by sea, which really didn't... I didn't have much detailed work on that. And they went then by sea to Port Sudan and then by rail to Deru Deb. 5th Brigade went by road and sea. Incidentally, the road party went from Cairo to Atbara, which is 900 miles away, in 5 days. It was a very good effort. 7th Brigade went by sea to Port Sudan. They left Cairo on Christmas Day. And the 11th Brigade, who were the first to leave, went to Port Sudan and then on by rail.
How did you actually travel down?
I travelled down in the greatest luxury. I went down by train to Aswan with my wife, who was then a VAD in the 15th Scottish Hospital in Cairo, and we had a flat. And then we stayed the night in a first-class hotel, which is empty. And I went on by boat, also in great comfort, down the Nile to Atbara. And then from there we went by cattle truck, anything we could, to division headquarters.
It sounds like you took the same route that General Gordon took.
I suppose so, yes.
And what happened to you then when you got to divisional headquarters?
I had to make contact then with... one of my tasks was to make contact with the brigades. That's the thing. The first thing I remember. I don't remember much else that I did at that time.
So you were still acting as a liaison officer?
I was still a liaison officer, yes.
How did you actually move about between the brigades?
At that time we were could use transport. We had our transport, so that was no difficulty that time.
And when did you rejoin your battalion?
I rejoined my battalion after the Battle of Akwa Khol, which my battalion had, and other battalions had, heavy casualties.
So in the early phases in Eritrea, you were at divisional headquarters?
I was in divisional headquarters, yes.
How large was the divisional headquarters?
It was not... we had an advanced divisional headquarters, which was fairly small, really. That's the operational side. And then the larger size was the rear headquarters, which dealt with all the organisation, administration, the medical and all that sort of thing. But the advanced headquarters was fairly tight.
How did General Beresford Pierce control his division? How did he make his plans? Did he do it by forming them in his own mind and then issuing orders, or did he do it by holding conferences and discussing?
Well, I think the first thing that he did was to confer with General Platt. That's when General Plan was then formed. And then he had his gay commanders up and then gave out his plans to them.
Was he a man who was open to suggestion from subordinates?
Oh yes, very much so. He's not that he always took them, but he's open to, my impression was, he was.
And what about General Platt? Was he open-minded?
I don't know much about General Platt. In fact, I don't think I ever met him.
Can I ask what was the state of intelligence at that time?
I don't think the state of intelligence was all that good in the early stages. On the other hand, it wasn't all that bad because we knew that where the enemy positions were, and we knew roughly their strength. But beyond that, as far as the junior ranks were concerned, we didn't know much. As the war went on, I noticed that when there was any action or anything, the junior ranks were put in the picture. But at this stage, reason being, of course, that the top brass didn't know exactly all that amount about the enemy. It didn't filter right down to the junior ranks.
Do you know how this information that was available had been gathered?
I don't know about that at all, because I imagine it must have been through local intelligence, local inhabitants, and what activity had been going on before.
And were you aware, as you had been at Sidi Barani, of the plan and our own intentions?
Well, owing to the speed of the move, we did know eventually, but to start with, there was a bit of confusion as far as I remember, simply because of the fact that we moved so fast.
So it just wasn't time to let you know what was happening?
There wasn't time to go down to the detailed plans. General plan was yes. People knew, but the detailed plan, I don't think we knew.
Was there any great change in the conditions of life when you moved down from Egypt to Sudan?